Hi there, Alphonse here, and coming up next we'll be chatting with Dr. David Ray Griffin, who is a professor emeritus at the Claremont School of Theology, where he taught for over 30 years, retiring in 2004. He has authored or edited over 24 books, including God and Religion in the Postmodern World, Religion and Scientific Naturalism, The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11, the 911 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and he's got a new book on the way, should be out in a month or so, called Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11. You're listening to the Grassroots Infomedias of the People radio show. We're the official radio show of the Veterans for 9/11 Truth. And we welcome Dr. David Ray Griffin. How are you today?
Fine. Good to be with you.
So, Dr. Griffin, you've been speaking out and writing books about 9/11 and exposing some of the truths you've clearly seen as wrong. What woke you up to this truth, and what made you speak out?
Yeah, I was kind of a Johnny-come-lately to the movement. At first, I accepted the standard liberal view that this was blowback for U.S. foreign policy, and so I started doing research on U.S. imperialism, and that has turned out to stand me in good stead because I learned the framework for this event. In any case, about a year and a half after 9/11, a colleague sent me email with Paul Thompson's with a website that had Paul Thompson's massive timeline on it. So when I started reading that, even though earlier I had looked at a little bit of evidence and dismissed it as unconvincing, this time I saw that there were literally dozens of stories that had come out in mainstream publications that contradicted the official account. So then I started looking into it more deeply and decided I'd write an article, and it got longer and longer, and that's how the New Pearl Harbor came about.
Well, that's good. We're glad to have you on board in the 9/11 truth movement because you tell it so well and so thoroughly, and it's very organized and easy to understand manner. I know that you've done quite a bit of research into the 911 Commission itself, and especially Commissioner Zelikow.
He was the executive director, actually. And that's very significant because, the commissioners we saw on TV, they didn't do the work. They simply took what the staff had given to them and then discussed it. And so the staff did all the work, and Zelikow directed the staff. That's what the executive director does. And also he guides the production of the final book, final report. And so you had a staff of about 80 people there, and divided into various teams. So he decided what would be researched and, of course, what would not be researched. And when people say this was an independent commission, they need to look very carefully at who Philip Zelikow was. He had worked on the National Security Council of the first President Bush, and that's where he and Condoleezza Rice became acquainted and became very good friends. Such good friends and ideological comrades that when the Republicans were out of power during the Clinton years, they wrote a book together. Then when she became appointed National Security Advisor for the second President Bush, she brought on Zelikow to help with the transition. And then, and here's something that thus far hasn't been well publicized, and I didn't even know it when I wrote my critique, she had brought him on to write the document that's known as National Security Council Strategy of the United States of America 2002. And the reason this is important is this was an extremely bellicose document. And in fact, the first draft had been written by the State Department and by Richard Haass, and she looked at it and said, oh, we need something much bolder, and presidency, she brought on Zelikow, and he produced this very bold document that is a typical neoconservative document. In fact, Max Boot has said it's a quintessentially neocon document. And the crucial new thing in this was the doctrine of preventive preemptive warfare.
Yes.
Now, Bush had already announced this at his West Point speech, that is, that we're no longer going to wait to be attacked. We'll go on the offensive and attack countries before they can get the wherewithal to attack us. And, of course, that's an extreme violation of international law. You're not allowed to do preemptive warfare unless you have certain intelligence that the other country is about to attack you so immediately there's no time to take it to the National Security Council. So this document that was written by Zelikow revises that and says now the United States will presume the right to attack countries before there's an imminent attack. And so this means we can just go attack anybody we want to, even though, as in the case of Iraq, we knew that it would be 10 years before they would have anything that could come close to posing a danger to us or to their neighbors. So to bring on Zelikow then to head this seemingly impartial commission, which was supposed to ask, among other questions, might the United States government itself have been complicit in the attacks? Would they have had any motives for the attacks? Of course, is absurd.
Yeah, this that security strategy, that's incredible to me, because it's like a paranoid hypothesis which justifies doing whatever you want.
Exactly.
It's like, come on, you know, that does it, you know, and once you do your preemptive strike, you can't, no one can prove or disprove that your hypothesis was correct, because you've destroyed that that avenue that could have been taken, which is not doing anything and just waiting. And in the case of Iraq, if we would have just waited, we would have probably found out that that we didn't need to invade.
Well, they knew that, and of course we have the Downing Street, the first of the Downing Street memos, which shows that the head of British intelligence had just visited the United States and had just met with our top intelligence people, and he reported back to Tony Blair that we were going to go to a war with Iraq, and that the basis was going to be weapons of mass destruction. And when the question came up, well, how would we know that they really had weapons of mass destruction? The answer was, well, the intelligence will be fixed around the policy. The intelligence,
yes,
and the facts will be fixed around the policy.
Yeah. Smoking gun mushroom cloud comes to mind.
So when the news report, people keep saying, well, we were mistaken, the intelligence was bad. No, the intelligence wasn't bad. Our CIA knew, our DIA knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. They deliberately allowed the intelligence to be fabricated.
More than intelligence, it was probably closer to propaganda.
Well, sure, that's what manipulating the facts means, issuing propaganda.
And that's what they did. I understand, too, that Zelikow was associated with National Security Advisor, former aide to the National Security Advisor, Brent Scowcroft, under Bush 1.
That's right. It was he and Condoleezza Rice worked under Scowcroft.
And Scowcroft was, he was instrumental in making sure that the Kuwaitis could slant drill into Iraq, which kind of set the set off the fire there in the first Gulf War.
So that's right. It's still relatively unknown in America, or virtually unknown, that whole war was set up deliberately.
Babies being thrown out of incubators. And
that's right.
And
absolute
that.
Lies. They hired a public relations firm to create this impression that these horrors were going on, and that we needed to come to the rescue.
Well, I've got a list of all the 911 commissioners. you probably know a little about each one, and according to many, all of them, with the exception of one, had tremendous conflicts of interest, and the one that may not have had conflicts of interest, at least not at the time, was Senator Cleland. And he said, the Warren Commission blew it. I'm not going to be a part of that. I'm not going to be part of looking at information only partially. I'm not going to be part of just coming to a quick conclusions. I'm not going to be part of a political pressure to do this or not do that. And he was right about a lot of things in there. He was not going to be part of the 9/11 commission. They kicked him upstairs. That was kind of an interesting move on the part.
That's right, and that's very important because the when you read the preface or forward to the 9/11 commission report that Kane and Hamilton wrote, you see they're very proud of the fact that they had a unanimous report. Well, if Cleland had been still on there, it's most likely they would not have had a unanimous report. And so, of course, he needed a job. He needed a paying job because even though he had lost his limbs in Vietnam, he was accused by the Republican slime machine during the campaign of being insufficiently patriotic. He lost his seat. And so he needed a job, and he had been nominated by the Democrats for this position on a board that did pay a salary. And after he started making all these noises rather publicly about the inadequate work of the commission and suggesting, as you said, that it was heading towards being another Warren Commission, suddenly Bush rushed through his approval of Max Cleland's appointment to this board, so they got rid of him.
Yeah, the Export-Import Bank, it says here.
That's right, yeah.
And then you've got Thomas Kane.
Kane, they pronounce it.
Kane.
Yeah.
Yep, director of a giant Armada Hess, business ties to Saudi, Khalid Ben Mafiz, co-chairman of Homeland Security Project, and CFR member.
Yeah, so when I put the burden on Zelikow, I don't mean to take it off of the commissioners because they were all people who did have conflicts of interest of one sort or another, or at least apparent conflicts of interest. And so it would not have been very easy to manipulate them into accepting things in the report that they knew to be false. For example, as I report in the book, Bob Kerry, who replaced Cleland, he's also a rather outspoken fellow, and he said that they had come up with definite knowledge of Saudi Arabian financing of Al-Qaeda. Well, when the final, and he said, I don't know how we're going to deal with that in the final report. The way they did it in the final report was the way they did it with everything else. Either just omit it or tell a lie. And that's why I subtitled the book Omissions and Distortions. In this case, they just decided to tell a lie. Well, they omitted all the facts that they had. And then they told a bald-faced lie saying, we found no evidence whatsoever of any foreign government funding of Al-Qaeda. And they had very extremely strong evidence that both Saudi Arabia and Pakistan been funding Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, exactly who was funding Al-Qaeda is really tough to say. There's evidence that during a meeting, Portugas was meeting with, what's his name, the guy from ISI.
Mahmoud, yeah.
Mahmoud Ahmed had just wired $100,000 to one of the alleged hijackers, Mohammed Atta.
Yeah.
And then he's meeting with Portugas, who now recently stepped down from head of the CIA. And we've got a real mess going on here with exactly who done it. And I know I'm pretty sure that the official government story, well, I'm absolutely sure, is not correct. There's just too many, you can't have diametrically opposed claims and ideas and have both of them be the truth. You know, so something is definitely wrong, and you can see that without any scientific expertise. All you have to do is read.
That's right. A lot of people ask me, how are you as a philosopher of religion and theologian? What expertise do you have to deal with these issues? And I said, well, I can read, and I can think somewhat logically. And that's what people need to know, that they, the scientific evidence, say, about the Twin Towers and Building 7, this is not very difficult stuff. Anybody with, say, an eighth grade education can read the material and see that the official story is just absolutely impossible because, for example, they first tried to tell us that the fire in the towers melted the steel. And you had documentaries coming on the BBC and Nova saying these things and even quoting scientists as saying these things. And yet, all you have to know is the steel does not begin to melt until 2800 degrees Fahrenheit, and that an open hydrocarbon fire cannot possibly get over 1700 degrees. So you're at least 1,000 degrees short, and surely much more than that, because these were not very hot hydrocarbon fires, and they didn't last very long. So with just elementary capacity to read, you can find out that the official story is just absolute nonsense.
It sure is. And it's not rocket science. It's not even advanced physics.
No, it's not advanced physics. I say an eighth grade education is all you really need.
Yeah.
And that's, because that's what my dad had, and he was able to read such stuff and figure out what kind of stuff was nonsense.
Well, the idea that jet fuel is going to melt steel is just absurd.
Because some people
kerosene.
Say, jet fuel, jet fuel. Well, jet fuel is basically kerosene.
Yeah.
And try putting, light a kerosene fire in your potbelly stove. Let it burn all day and see if you can get that stove to melt.
No, you won't. Otherwise, kerosene heaters would be out of the question.
That's
You'd have to make them out of what? If
it's
steel won't work, then what?
Yeah, it is really elementary. And and to go back to the commission, here's how they dealt with the problems with the towers and then Building 7. With the towers, the big mystery is, how could these buildings, 110 stories high, that had core columns, the core was made of 47 really massive steel columns that went all the way from the sub-basements to above the roof, how could those have completely collapsed into a pile of rubble only a few stories high if by some remote, really impossibility, but some remote possibility, fire had somehow caused them to melt and come down? How could this all have happened? First of all, at free fall speed, just about free fall speed, and then collapsed into this pile of rubble only a few stories high. Well, what the 9/11 Commission said was the core of each tower consisted of a hollow steel shaft. So they simply denied the most prominent feature of these buildings, which were these 47 core columns. And then if you ask, well, what about Building 7? How did they explain its collapse in spite of the fact it wasn't even hit by a plane? And that's what they try to say, that somehow the plane crashing into an upper floor of the towers somehow caused them to collapse, even though they were built to absorb such crashes. What would they do with Building 7? Well, they simply didn't mention in their 571-page report that Building 7 collapsed, even though this would have been a first. It would have been the first time in history that a steel frame, high-rise building had collapsed totally because of fire. This would be a historic event that should have sent insurance companies around the world to refiguring their policies, because they say, oh, gee, we didn't know that fire could make the building completely collapse.
Have to redo the
We've
risk
got to
assessment.
Increase the premiums here, and the 9/11 Commission report doesn't even mention.
Well, they probably will increase their premiums. I know that the reinsurance companies were quite concerned, because now they can't, if buildings like that collapse for those reasons, you can't assess the risk. Therefore, you know, it would be not prudent to be an insurance company, and they're not going to be.
Yeah.
That's going to be the taxpayer now that's the reinsurance company.
Back to Building 7, let me emphasize here that many people in the movement, and I tend to agree with them, think that the real Achilles heel of the official story is Building 7. And you will see that the government and corporately owned networks do everything possible to keep the public from thinking about Building 7 and the fact that it's collapsed. In fact, we just recently had a Zogby poll, nationwide Zogby poll, taken to get people's thoughts about 9/11. And it was found that only 52% of the public had heard that Building 7 had collapsed.
Wow.
That shows you that, you know, how many times have we seen the planes crash into the towers?
Yeah, they emphasize that.
Hundreds of times. How many times have you seen Building 7 collapse?
They won't play it.
They showed it the first night, and you know, good old Dan Rather says, "Hey, that looks like just one of those buildings we've seen so many times that they brought down with explosives." Well, I don't think they ever ran that again, and I don't think Dan was ever allowed to say that again, and I don't know that anybody else ever said that again. You know, after somebody got to him and said, you know, this is not what you're supposed to be saying here. And so 43% did not know, said they had never heard of this fact.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the 9/11 Commission report, so if they read that, they would never learn about it. If you watch the evening news, you never learn about it.
Well, that's a real testimony to the power of the mainstream media, the so-called mainstream media. Just by not saying anything, they've basically controlled the minds of 52% of the people, because you're out of mind. You know, if you don't know about something, you can't be concerned about it very well.
That's right.
It's very disconcerting, that Building 7 collapse, because it goes at the speed of free fall, with no resistance, not even air resistance. So there's something wrong there.
Yeah, because the only way that can happen is if before the upper floors start coming down, the lower floors have collapsed first. So this is, this is the standard controlled implosion,
mm-hmm.
in which the, with the towers, it was not a standard one, because the collapse needed to start from near the top, near the place where the airplanes hit, so they could blame the collapse on the airplane strikes. But with Building 7, they didn't need to do all that, so it was just a much simpler, old-fashioned, standard implosion, which starts from the bottom, and the building folds in on itself, implodes in on itself.
You can see it quite clearly.
Yeah.
The top of the building begins to bow, as if the inside of the building, the very inside structure, was pulling down and pulling the outside walls in, just like you would expect from a controlled demolition.
That's right, and that means that the columns in that building, it was not nearly as big, of course, as the towers, but it was still a pretty good-sized building.
47 stories.
47 stories, and just about filled a city block there. And so you still had a lot of steel columns in there. That means all of those columns had to collapse simultaneously.
Yes.
Now try to get somebody who can explain to you how fire could, which was unevenly. In fact, it was only there were only fires in about three stories, three floors of that building. The photographs show you that rather close to the time of collapse. How fires in a few places in the building could have caused all of the columns
the
inside
symmetry.
And around the periphery of the building to collapse simultaneously. So if you want anything close to absolute proof buildings were brought down by explosives, all you have to do is meditate on that fact.
Right. If there is any such thing as absolute truth, that's getting to it right there. I mean, it's really irrefutable because you've got the forensic evidence of the video, and you've got the speed of collapse. And 47-story buildings don't normally get into a vacuum somehow. And that's what you would need to make that kind of speed, because you'd have terminal velocity to deal with if it was in atmosphere. So it had to be in a vacuum. And how do you get a vacuum? Well, you got to evacuate all the oxygen, all the atmosphere. And somehow that happened. And how do you do that? You need something pretty energetic, like explosives, really strong explosives to do it. So it's ridiculous. It's scientifically provable. And, you know, so we need to, you know, start a grand jury, I do believe.
Yeah, and now if your listeners want to say, well, you know, you guys, you know, you don't have any scientific credentials.
Well, actually, I do.
That's true about me. You do, huh?
BS in geology.
Yeah, but they'll say, well, you know, you're not a physicist or a structural engineer.
Yeah, right.
And so they used to taunt us with that, but now, you know, we had a very good physicist from the beginning, Jim Hoffman.
Yes.
Of course, people could say, well, he didn't have a PhD. Okay, so his work inspired
appeal to authority
Stephen Jones.
Right.
Stephen Jones is a PhD physicist, and now he has looked at the collapse of the towers very rigorously. And he has come to the same conclusion. There is just no possible explanation of this. And then some people say, well, look, physics isn't really the right discipline. What you need is mechanical engineering. Okay, go to Judy Wood. So people can go to this new, fairly new organization. Another thing people said is, you know, it's a bunch of crazies on the Internet. Well, go to this Google. Scholars for 9/11 Truth.
Mm-hmm.
And then under the heading, Who Are We? Look on there and you'll find a whole bunch of people with PhDs who, most of them are professors in various places. And go to Judy Wood and you will find that she is a structural mechanical engineer. And she has written an absolutely devastating paper that is placed on that website. Now we have it from engineers as well as physicists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Judy D. Wood, professor of mechanical engineering at Clemson University with degrees in civil engineering, engineering mechanics, and materials engineering science. And she's going to be part of the debate team, the national 911 debate.
If we get anybody to debate us.
Right, right. And I think, you're on there too, aren't you?
Yeah, Dr. in fact, let me mention, it's this Ed Haas, H-A-A-S, who has a blog called the Muckraker Report.
Yes.
And people can find that on by going to Google, just Muckraker Report. And you'll see that he has a bunch of really good stories in there. And one of those stories has the heading, I don't understand the public's fascination with Building 7. Well, Haas interviewed Michael Newman, who's the public affairs representative for NIST. NIST being the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which of course did the official report on the towers. Now, it was, and by the way, both Hoffman and Stephen Jones have written devastating critiques of NIST report, which people can also find on by going to Google. NIST was also supposed to explain why Building 7 collapsed. They have not issued that report. they issued a tentative report, which got immediately got very critical reviews. They withdrew that. And now, anyway, Haas has asked them, asked this Newman, he says, well, look, you've got your 30 NIST scientists, and then you've got some other scientists out here who disagree with your report, and they're telling the public not to trust your report. Why don't we just have a public debate, and you can settle the issue? And he reports that Newman told him no NIST scientist is going to engage in any public debate about their report.
No, I don't blame them because they'll get beat.
And actually, Newman admitted, in effect, admitted that and said, "Well, there's no winning such debates," even though he had been ridiculing these other alternative scientists by comparing them to people who believe in Bigfoot and the flat Earth.
Well, that's...
And he says, "You know, with such people, no matter what evidence you give, there's no convincing them." And so for him to say that he couldn't, that they couldn't go on a public debate on public TV and make these ridiculous scientists show them up to be ridiculous, really just gives the case away. That is, that he has no confidence in the report, and he knows the NIST scientists have no confidence in
the
report.
No, they don't. They can't. Well, they refused to release the computer model that explained the collapse of the World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2. Why? Probably because it won't work. Because it was going to be the pancake effect is what they were had in a computer model, and of course it won't work. It's not going to work.
Yeah, and they don't actually endorse the traditional pancake, the one that served as kind of the official story for the first years, and the one that the 9/11 Commission report. They worked out a new one that, rather than the floors breaking loose from all the rivets holding them to the columns, that they didn't break loose, and therefore they pulled the columns down or made them break. And so it's hard to know which of the two theories is more ridiculous, but...
they pulled them down. 47 contiguous box beams standing on end, and they just kind of pulled them down. It's... try to visualize that happening, like noodles or something. I don't
know. Yeah, and then reconcile that with what you see on TV with these things that they, you've got these buildings that are absolutely stable, and you don't find beams suddenly, you know, starting to sag or anything like it was fire. You see them almost completely stable, and then suddenly they go straight down. As you say, virtually free fall speed, and in the case of Building 7, at free fall speed, and they're supposed, somehow we're supposed to believe that this is all produced by the floors pulling and making the steel columns buckle.
Well, those pyroclastic clouds that were expanding, and those things were, for all intents and purposes, virtually solid, and they were dropping as if they were a solid, falling. And they were shooting out at 50 foot per second. I mean, it's just amazing the amount of energy that would be necessary to cause that to happen. And this is pointed out very clearly by Jim Hoffman and noticed by any other physicist that takes a look. You'd say, what the heck are those big clouds? Things fall down. They don't fall out. You know, there was building material ejected for 2 football fields, 200 yards, and embedding in nearby buildings. Well, that's not falling. That's shooting.
That's right. So these had to be, and of course that makes sense because these were the biggest buildings ever brought down by controlled demolition. And so the explosives would have had to be much more powerful than those in other buildings. So, as I report in my books and in a paper I've written, which you can find on Google, just called the Collapse of the World Trade Center Buildings, Why the Official Story Can't Be True, and I used the work of Hoffman and Jones and report on this. The other factor is that the dust clouds are much bigger, and the amount of material in the buildings that is pulverized into dust is much more complete. In fact, virtually everything other than the steel was pulverized into very tiny dust particles, whereas in other buildings, and I report those in the paper, like the Seattle King Dome and another building, you can see the dust clouds come, but still there's the building remaining. It is not the whole building that goes, but with the towers, it's the whole building that is pulverized into tiny dust particles. So the explosives had to be enormously powerful. And so, yes, powerful enough that they could explode aluminum and steel beams more than 100 yards.
Yeah.
And upwards.
Upwards.
And they begin going upwards, not just, they're not falling down.
Yeah,
so
things are
gravity.
Falling up and out.
Yeah. Whereas the official story is the collapse was caused totally by gravity. And I think one thing we all know, with at least with eighth grade educations, is that gravity only pulls things down on Earth.
Yes. Yep.
Well, in this paper, by the way, and I should say that in my the forthcoming book that you mentioned, Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11, the first half of it consists of some new papers I had written after my previous books. And one of them is this one on the collapse of the World Trade Center. Another one is a complete, fairly complete, the most complete one yet, survey of the witnesses to explosives in the towers. And these are just remarkable testimonies from firemen and emergency medical workers who were there that day.
Mm-hmm.
And just literally dozens of them report hearing explosions, sometimes 7 or 8 or 10 explosions in the building, and seeing demolition rings going around the outside, seeing flashes in the building. And many of them remark, this was just like these examples of controlled demolition that we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
So these are in this new book, so people will be able to read them in book form too.
Did you mention anything about the seismic anomalies that were discovered by the Columbia University Geology Department at their seismograph at the Palisades?
Yeah, that evidence is somewhat controversial. Jim Hoffman, for example, is critical of that and doesn't think it shows what some other people have said. So I've remained agnostic on that, and did not include it in my latest report. Tried to just limit it to self to things that that seem to be uncontroversial within the movement. But one thing that very few people know that is interesting about the seismic report, they also reported that although they got definite readings when at the times that the airplanes hit the towers,
mm-hmm.
they got no such reading when whatever it was that hit the Pentagon hit the mm-hmm. Pentagon. So isn't that interesting that a Boeing 757 or 767 striking the towers would cause a seismic reaction, but the virtually the same kind of size of airplane hitting the Pentagon wouldn't?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is interesting.
And of course,
quite a few interesting things. See, I know that there was a 2.3, a 2.1, and with the case with Building 7, 0.6. 0.6.
Smaller.
You should see proportional, predictable proportional differences between the buildings, and you don't. Therefore, that's conclusive evidence that it wasn't the buildings causing the ground shaking. Something else was. Otherwise, you'd see predictable proportional differences, and on the seismic scale, the difference between a 1 and a 2 is double, and it doubles like that.
That's right. And in this paper on if people want to Google it, it's just called explosive testimony.
Mm-hmm.
They can find that you have many witnesses reporting that the ground was shaking prior to the time that the buildings started to collapse.
Right. Well, of course, there's that video, 9/11 eyewitness, where you can hear the explosions. They sound like thunderclaps before the building even begins to budge.
Yeah.
And those are recorded in that seismic evidence that corroborates what you hear with what the ground was doing as well.
That's right. And of course, this fits with what William Rodriguez, who was in the basement of the North Tower, said, that he and his co-workers felt a massive explosion, or what seemed to be an explosion, massive shaking beneath their feet prior to the time the building was struck by the airplane, and then that another co-worker came running into the room covering with flames, reporting that fire had come up the elevator from the basement, so from the sub-basements, and set him on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And this fits with what I report in that paper, Explosive Testimony, that you have several people from outside who said they felt the ground shaking prior to the beginning. And then you have Marc Loiseau, who is the president of Controlled Demolition, which of course was the company that came and cleaned up the World Trade Center. And his is one of the companies in the world, one of the relatively few companies in the world that has the expertise to bring off a true implosion. People can read this by going to implosionworld.com. And you'll find on there that they say that there are only a handful of companies in the world with the ability to pull off a true implosion as opposed to other kinds of controlled demolition. And he reported that if he had been given the job of bringing down the World Trade Center, he would have started by exploding the, by breaking the steel columns in the sub-basements.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That appears to be what happened, too.
Exactly, yeah.
And then there was molten metal that persisted for about 90 days.
Oh, or longer, actually.
Yeah.
And Loiseau reported on that, too. He was a little incautious in some of the things he said. But also Peter Tully, president of another company that was involved in the cleanup, also reported on. And Stephen Jones, one of the ways he got into this was the molten metal, because as a physicist, he knew that molten metal could not be produced unless you had temperatures way in excess of, you know, I said 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, simply to make steel begin to melt, but to make it melt suddenly, you know, to slice steel and to make it turn into molten metal,
and then persist
it has to be
for a long time,
way
too.
Up there, several thousand degrees. So that was what I believe initially got his attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so in his paper, he reports on this, and we have testimonies. I include some of this in my own paper on the World Trade Center collapse. Testimonies from several people who were there involved in the cleanup, who reported the molten steel was still molten, as you say, months afterwards. So this has to be very hot.
Sounds almost catalytic, like it was feeding itself.
Yeah.
I don't know where you get the energy from to make it persist that long.
Yeah, it has to be
unless it's some kind of catalytic reaction.
Yeah, and Stephen shows when he does his lectures, he uses slides and videos,
mm-hmm.
and in his videos he shows you the molten steel streaming down the outside of the building. It's remarkable.
Mm.
So when you start looking at the cumulative evidence here, Somebody just sent around a little thing on the web called Occam's Razor in 9/11. And of course, Occam's Razor is the principle that all other things being equal, the simplest explanation should be preferred.
Yeah.
And if you look at the issues about the collapse of the towers, you find that they have all these phenomena that can all be explained in terms of explosives. So we've mentioned some of them: molten steel, free fall speed, coming straight down rather than toppling over, producing enormous dust clouds.
The speed with which things expand.
Yeah, and then the fact that it was total collapse, so that means all the steel columns had to be sliced into fairly small pieces. And on, I list a dozen of them. All of those can be explained by the one hypothesis of massive explosives used. Whereas, if you try to accept the official story, somehow you've got to explain how fire could do this, why this would happen, why this would happen. You need a very complex explanation for all these phenomena.
It can't be explained.
Some of us, and I've reported on this and others have too, have tried to figure out statistically. They say, well, you know, let's say that just for the sake of argument, there might be a 1 in 100 chance that fire would bring down steel frame high-rise building. And let's say there would be 1 in 100 chance that they could bring them down at free fall speed. Of course, that's ridiculous. There wouldn't be. But even if you grant all of those ridiculous possibilities, you end up with a total, and then you say this happened 3 times in one day. Well, it never happened before, never happened since. You're up into the astronomical, you know, well, one chance in a trillion or something like that.
I suppose anything's possible because we don't know what the laws of physics are going to do next. But they've been doing the same thing for, the last 15 billion years as far as we can tell. So it's not likely that they're going to change their mind for one day.
Yeah, one guy wrote a funny little article called Muslim Physics and how these Muslim hijackers had been able to subvert all these laws of physics that had been holding firm for all this time.
Yeah, that's just, we know, I'm sure that you know, and I know, with a little scientific background that I have, that there's something really fishy going on here, and there's just mountains of evidence that we in the 9/11 truth movement have captured, people like Stephen Jones and Jim Hoffman and yourself, and it's to any reasonable individual who looks at the evidence, there's just no way that you couldn't at least become suspicious.
That's right, and it's remarkable how many people are now suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
This Zogby poll, and if people want to read it, you can go on 911truth.org. That's 911 without a slash in it, just 911truth.org. And you can find this Zogby poll plus their press release about it. And it's really remarkable that given the fact that 99.9% of all the coverage in the mainstream media repeats the official story or just takes the official story for granted and praises the 9/11 Commission. Remember after Katrina, there was this call for, we need an independent Katrina Commission modeled on the 9/11 Independent Commission. And all of this, this poll showed that after all that, only 48% of the American public is confident that the government and the 9/11 Commission have not been covering up the truth about 9/11.
Is that not staggering? It is.
Less than
people
half.
People are smarter than I thought they were.
Exactly.
I'm glad that 911truth.org commission the Zogby poll so we could see where we stood in this information war. And it appears to me like they're losing the information war because they have a complete monopoly on information, and they're still the people are still seeing through the lies and the deceptions. They understand.
Yeah. Now, of course, it depends on what you do get exposed to. So it means that that over half of the public, it looks like, have been exposed to at least enough information from organizations such as yours and 9/11 Truth and Scholars for Truth and so on, and these various videos that are going around now that are exposing millions of people to these facts that contradict the official story. But let me repeat or give one more statistic here that is remarkable. I mentioned earlier that 43% of the people said they had never heard that Building 7 collapsed. The same exact figure, 43% of the people said they thought the mainstream news media were doing a good or even excellent job of giving us information about 9/11.
Yeah, I guess they don't have the equipment to judge because they didn't even know what happened.
Yeah, obviously. Isn't that remarkable, though, that the figure is exactly the same? 43%, the same ones who believe the news media are doing a good job, had never heard that Building 7 collapsed.
Well, it's obvious that they weren't equipped to, they didn't have the knowledge to really assess the job they were doing because they didn't know what happened.
That's right. Particularly if you just watch Fox News, you don't know what you're missing.
Right. How do you know what you're missing?
If you watch Fox News, there's a high percentage of chance that you still believe that Iraq and Saddam Hussein were connected with Al-Qaeda and even involved in 9/11.
Yeah. Well, there was a poll done, I think it was by Zogby. 72% of Americans believe that Saddam had at least something to do with 911.
Yeah, and a high percentage of those said they got their primary, that Fox News was the primary source of their information.
Yep. So, yes. And Fox News really never said that. They sort of implied it with pictures. That first they'd show the towers collapsing, and then a few moments later you'd see Saddam shooting that shotgun with a funny hat on.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's a propaganda machine, and I don't know if you have to be an expert in sociology to see the effect it has, but doggone it, I can see it.
This suggests a new theory, that it was Saddam's shotgun who brought down the
That's a good one there.
Well, it's on the one hand, it's so funny, it's so ridiculous, you can't help but laugh. But on the other hand, it's so tragic.
It is.
Because
death and destruction
and
are coming out.
This combination of lies, when you start looking at the details, they're all so obvious. And that the whole thing was fabricated. And a large part of my new book then goes into showing that the connection between 9/11 and the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And of course, these wars were on the books long before 9/11. Both of them were already planned. The neocons had been militating to attack Iran. Iran and Iraq, but Iraq first, ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. They started saying, look, we can have a unipolar world, heck to this bipolar world, where we have to share power. We can be the whole thing, we can be in control, and we can just start doing whatever we want to, but we need to get control of the Mideast. And so since 1991, when Papa Bush would not go on to Baghdad and take it over, they've been militating, and so they had written letters to President Clinton begging him to go to war with Iraq and all this. So this was all ready, and as several members of the Bush administration now have reported, you know, Secretary of Treasury O'Neill and Richard Clark, that they came into office with Iraq number one on their agenda. And so the idea that somehow it was just a coincidence that we got an attack from Arab Muslims, and so that we could attack both Afghanistan and Iraq, the idea that that's just a coincidence. You see that this whole philosophy, they had a bunch of motives, a bunch of things they wanted to get through. It included a great increase in the defense budget, what they call the defense budget. They know it's the offense budget. Mm-hmm. And then they wanted to the right to attack Afghanistan and Iraq, and they also wanted this doctrine of preemptive warfare.
Mm-hmm.
They'd been saying, you know, we've got to be able to go on the offensive whenever we want to. And so it was 9/11 that gave them the pretext to do that, and as I say, then Zelikow is the one who came in and wrote the document that said, now we've got the right to do this. And so when people read that, I believe they'll see that this tragedy that is developed in Iraq all goes back to you know, greed and imperial lust, which was then facilitated by 9/11.
Mm. Yeah, these things that were that you're talking about there were all set down long time ago, really. Probably Zbigniew Brzezinski in his book, The Grand Chessboard. That's part of it. And then you look at the Project for the New American Century, some of the things they said. That's probably where you got your title for your book, The New Pearl Harbor, from that same document. And you can see what their plans are. I mean, they just basically come out and say it. And all you have to do is read it and understand it, and you can see that what's taking place is the result of what they thought about back in anywhere from the early 90s to the late 90s.
Yeah, it was actually in 1992 that this that Cheney ordered Wolfowitz and Libby to produce this new version of the defense planning guidance. They produced a draft of that, and it had this very bellicose doctrine in there. And in those days, it caused such an outrage that they publicly had to withdraw it, and Cheney even pretended like he didn't know about it, didn't have anything to do with it, even though it thanked him for guidance. And Wolfowitz lied too, saying, well, gee, I really didn't have anything to do with this, and now he takes credit for it. But so that's been in the works all along, and of course Dick Cheney is the guiding light of this this new kind of more bellicose imperialism. And so it's been a long time in the making, but all these things they wanted, 9/11 gave it to them.
Magically. That's what they said they needed.
Yeah, yeah, so any of your listeners who don't know, organization that was formed in the 90s called the Project for the New American Century, which is really a unipolarist organization. They wanted a unipolar world. They put out this document in the fall of 2000, just before the Bush administration was to take office. And in this, they were talking about how they were going to revolutionize the military, have this transformation of military affairs, at the very center of which was weaponizing space. And, of course, that's mm-hmm. going to be extremely expensive. We're talking trillions of dollars here. And so they said this process of transformation will probably go slowly, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, such as a new Pearl Harbor.
Exactly.
So like you say, virtually coming right out and saying, if only we could have a new Pearl Harbor type event, we could get what we wanted. And here, as you mentioned, they plagiarized Brzezinski, because he had virtually said this in 1997 in the Grand Chessboard. There he was talking about getting command control of the of Central Asia with its oil around the Caspian Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that's what the invasion of Afghanistan allowed then, and we put up our military bases in Afghanistan. surrounding countries and
right on the oil pipelines.
facilitate the gas and oil pipeline.
Right on the, we put our military right on the proposed pipelines. The ones that, do you remember the statement made, you could either have carpets of gold or carpets of bombs?
Yeah, this was a meeting in Berlin in July of 2001. And, you know, the Clinton administration had given up on the Taliban and had decided to go an alternate route for the oil and gas. But when the Bush administration came into office, they decided to give the Taliban one more chance. And, of course, what one more chance was to form a unity government in which the Taliban would allow people who were American-friendly into the government and then be able to provide security for the pipeline. And the Taliban refused, but the line that was, somebody report, the Pakistani representative reported that one of the Americans said, well, either you can accept our carpet of gold or we will shower you in a carpet of bombs. And the Pakistani representative also said that one of them said that the war in Afghanistan would begin before the snows of October.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, by having 9/11 happen on 9/11, that gave us
sure
a month to get ready to gear up for the war logistically. And so the war started on October 7th, sure enough, before the snows started.
That was prophetic.
Another coincidence.
Another one.
Yeah.
Don't know how many there are, but there are tons of